Hello, you're listening to Generation Squeeze's Hard Truths. I'm Megan Wild.
And I'm Paul Kershaw.
This past spring, Generation Squeeze, the Future Ready Initiative, and Habitat for Humanity GTA organized a three-part discussion series about housing in the GTA, hosted at the Ismaili Center with funding from the Kanna Rector Foundation. Our shared goal was to help Torontonians see beyond the usual headlines about the housing crisis so they could move forward on solutions. The discussion tackled lots of thorny issues that we thought our listeners across the country might be interested in, like the interplay of housing and immigration, who pays and who gains when home prices rise, and what potpourri of solutions will finally fix this crisis. So, for today's episode, Paul is reuniting with a few of the panelists, Aline Punja and Ian Underwood, to share some of their stories, insights, and solutions. Aline Punja leads the Future Ready Initiative, the flagship community-based organization of the Aga Khan Council for Canada. He also serves on the Toronto Lands Corporation Board of Directors and Civic Action's Emerging Leaders Network. Ian Underwood has been the CEO of Habitat for Humanity Greater Toronto Area for over a decade. She also served on Ontario's Housing Affordability Task Force. Now I'll pass the baton to Paul.
Aleem and Ian, I just can't say how excited I am to bring the band back together after all of our time in Toronto for our dialogue sessions about housing and unaffordability and immigration in Toronto. So lovely to see you.
I am so excited for this. Thanks for the opportunity, Paul.
It's so great to be back together.
Oh, it's our pleasure here at Gen Squeeze. And I wanted to bring you onto our Hard Truth podcast because, you know, I was really appreciative of our collaboration for so many reasons. And, you know, you will know after having collaborated this long, and our listeners will know, that Gen Squeeze on housing can be viewed to be controversial because we have this view that, you know, in order to restore affordability for all, we really need to have a cultural shift where we don't want home prices to continue to rise. We want them to stall relative to earnings, giving earnings a chance to catch up. And there are moments where I can say that line so often that, you know, I'm like, oh, everyone's going to agree now. And, you know, we've done our polling that shows there's a decent amount of agreement, I guess, depending on how you ask the questions, perhaps. But when I got a chance to collaborate with you two lovely people, you know, it became clear, it was a reminder, like there are sensitivities around this. And so, Liam, I know that was in particular a sensitivity for you. I wonder if I could turn it to you first.
Well, thanks. Thanks for this, Paul. You know, I wouldn't say it's a sensitivity, but you know, there's a diversity of thought, right? And I can appreciate Generation Squeeze's position on this. And frankly, it's not that I don't agree. I actually do agree. But it's not about or, it's really and. And, you know, I get nervous when we look at policies in silos. And so when we look at housing as a housing issue, we look at immigration as an immigration issue, when we look at earnings as an earnings issue, et cetera. And so transportation as a transportation issue. And so that's where I get really nervous and where my lived and living experience certainly comes through. You know, Paul, I've shared with you and Ian, you've heard my family story. My story is not unique. But if I were to rewind that, my dad in particular grew up in the slums of India. I mean, he did not have a mud hut to live in. He lived in the local Jamaat Khana, which is a place of worship with my family, had lost his sister who was 3 years old, potentially because she was malnourished and really was a product of colonialism and the Indian independence. And so when I think about, you know, the humble beginnings that my family comes through and the poverty that my dad has seen and the values and the ethics and everything that he's instilled in my brother and I, of which we were able to kick poverty out of our family in one generation, although we still feel vulnerability and trauma towards that. And so when my family came to Canada, they started out in Thorncliffe Park in 65, and they started off in a one-bedroom apartment. And from there, we were able to buy a townhouse, buy another townhouse, which was relatively bigger. We started, you know, we moved to Scarborough. It was like, wow, I can't believe we're breaking out of Thorncliffe Park and moving to Scarborough. And then we moved to northern Scarborough, which was yet, wow, we're in Agent Court. This is awesome. For, you know, a fraction of the price. And we were able then to buy our Unionville home north of Steeles, where every brown person like me in that particular point in time in our lives thought it was like winning the lottery. And that was for $238,000, Paul. $238,000. My dad worked at the airport. My mom came out of actually being a hairdresser in the film industry in India. and went to Seneca College and became an accountant. And they worked at making, what, $40,000 less than, perhaps? I don't know exactly the exact numbers. And we were able to prosper because housing prices had gone from $238,000, of which they spent their last home, to whatever, to being able to put my brother and I through university, the first, I might add, in my family to go to university. And so it's within that lens, or perhaps within mm-hmm. that experience, that I want to preface my comments and my thinking. So I'll perhaps stop there.
Well, I think that your family story is such a lovely example of why the prospect of being able to accumulate security and stability and some wealth through the purchase of a home that not only provides that place to live, but also an opportunity for wealth accumulation to advance our prospects and invest in our kids, why that's so attractive. And I guess I found it so helpful during our time together to be reminded about that, because I think that attraction and you know, the beauty of the story that you just share, Aleem, and it's a story that I think many, many families across this country from coast to coast to coast could be sharing. And yet I think it is that very dynamic of being able to, you know, I often use this, it's kind of a loaded word, extract more wealth from the housing system relative to people's earnings, that then we risk leaving so little affordability left over. And I guess that's the tension where we're at now. And what does it mean to disrupt Canadian culture enough so that we preserve housing as a place to call home, even while we're trying to think through what are the ways that we use it as a way to gain financial security? And I think the kind of conversation we've had over the last while, and your story reminds me of, shows the difficulty of asking our politicians to kind of boldly be disruptive. Because as rents are crossing that 2,000 threshold per month on average in the country, I'm seeing $3,000 a month in Vancouver for a studio. Like, nobody with a full-time job can really afford even rent these days, so something needs to give. Ian, you've been engaging with us on these issues now for some time, and your org's, you know, been thinking a lot about these issues. You know, what would you encourage me to say differently?
I don't know if I can answer the last question, but I'm going to start with, I love the name of this podcast, Hard Truths, because that is absolutely where we are with housing right now, all these conundrums. And the challenge with housing is, for so many of us, it's happened so fast. And what a lot of younger people and newcomers to Canada may not appreciate is, you know, it actually did work for decades and decades. It worked until the turn of the century. In general, in Canada, housing prices were increasing, and you've demonstrated this with Jen Squeeze. They were generally increasing at the same rate as incomes. And then the two got so decoupled that we have these conundrums that we have today. And so I think the you know, the language of should housing prices stall, like, what do we need? But the question is, how do we restore a housing and an income regime, you know, that works? One of our speakers, as the two of you will recall, was Eric Lombardi from More Neighbors Toronto. One of the characterizations Eric used is, we are at risk of returning to a feudal society. You know, a world where you end up is a function of what you're born into, where you have, and I remember learning about this in grade 6 or 7 school, where we learned about, you know, how the French in Quebec, you know, they settled and you had the feudal landlords, and then everybody, you know, and the folks who are landlords and the folks who are renters, right? And so fast forward to where we are today, like, we're at risk, or there's this expectation of becoming a society where if you're born into a rental household, you're going to continue being a rental household. And back to your point, a rental household that isn't even going to be an appropriate household in its size or its affordability. And Aleem, I'm love that we started with Aleem's story, because Aleem's story was, no, it doesn't, you know, it didn't used to be that way. It used to be that if you, you know, worked hard and, you know, put down some roots and saved for a bit, you could own a home and you could use that home as a basis to get ahead. So there's a bunch of hard truths here. I think I'll pause there. As you know, my own journey with Habitat for Humanity and our, you know, because we're a charity that isn't just about housing, but that is about ownership. So I'm very keen to talk about our journey at Habitat for Humanity on all of these hard truths.
Well, let's use that as a segue. I mean, a lot of our conversation during the GTA Housing Dialogue series focused on immigration and how that was intersecting with housing. And I think we were trying to foreshadow for Torontonians and Canadians more generally that we need to deepen the way we understand these two themes of immigration and housing coming together. Perlim's over there. We don't want to talk about things in silos. And so in your view, what are some of the key issues that are not talked about enough in public dialogue as it relates to immigration and housing?
Well, one is now being talked about more, which is just that recognition of we have had, you know, decisions and targets, et cetera, made around immigration that are not related to decisions and targets and enablers around housing. You know, welcoming 500,000 newcomers a year and yet doing precious little or not enough to make sure that there's appropriate landing spaces in terms of housing for them. So, I mean, the good news is now people are recognizing the problem. You, Generation Squeeze, do a really good job of talking about why immigration is so vitally important to the future of this country. As we know, often we see in social media, oh, well, we can fix the problem. Let's just close the door to immigration. Wrong answer. So we have this issue about how do we get supply moving and the right kind of supply moving so that it can match up with the housing needs of new immigrants, as well as new family formation of all kinds, right? Of second generation or first generation Canadians, right? Where mom and dad came as immigrants, but the children are, you know, are here, are forming families and can't find an opportunity for adequate housing. So I think I'll pause there and hand it to Aline.
Thanks, Ian. I mean, those are really important points. And Paul, you do a really good job with articulating immigration. But I think it's incredibly important for us to talk about immigration in Canada with the lens of, or perhaps prefacing the fact that our country will collapse if we don't actually have immigration. The reality is that there's not enough people to be able to get into the labor market to keep this country running for years to come. So I'm incredibly concerned, to be honest, with a potential rhetoric, you know, that welcoming immigrants is this paternalistic thing that we're doing in Canada because we're a wonderful country and we're equal opportunity. The reality is that our country will collapse. Now, with that being said, Canada is a country of opportunity. It's a country that has values. It's a country that is designed to be able to be welcoming. I think the Aga Khan, who made this statement in the House of Commons in 2014, said it so beautifully. And I'm going to quote him here. He said, "I believe that Canada is uniquely able to articulate and exemplify three underpinnings of a quality civil society. One is a commitment to pluralism, to meritocracy, and to a cosmopolitan ethic. A cosmopolitan ethic is one that welcomes the complexity of human society. It balances rights and duties, freedom and responsibility. It is an ethic for all peoples, the familiar and the other, whether they live across the street or across the planet." And so when I think about the structures that we have, the legislative structures that we have, the human rights code, the fact that we have values that bring people together, the fact that we have a history in this country bringing settlers from other places to come and have an opportunity and prosper and being able to contribute to this country is incredibly important. I mean, the Century Institute talked about how we're on a track by 2100 to bring in, oh gosh, what was the number?
I think they imagine 100 million population in Canada.
Mm-hmm. 100 million. And that being fueled by, you know, by immigration. And so I think if we bring back the housing conversation, we need to get this right. I mean, the vacancy rate in Toronto is 1.7%. When you think about, Paul, what people are renting these days, no door solariums for $1,000 a month. You know, you go into Thorncliffe Park, of which I was just there last week, you have families piled into two-bedroom dilapidated buildings for $3,000 a month. And so we are in amongst a crisis, 110%. What I think we need to do is look at the situation holistically and figure out a pathway of a combination of different tools to be able to solve the problem.
Yeah, we've been thinking about, you know, the combination of tools for some time. And I just want to capture for our listeners two themes that were coming from you there, Aleem. On the one hand, as we're welcoming in hundreds of thousands of immigrants, that's partly in generosity. But to your point, that's also partly because our economy and governments requires it. We have an aging population where we got used some decades ago to there being 7 workers for every retiree. Now there are fewer than 3. And that makes it very, very difficult for our economy and our public finance, which is why we have turned to welcoming so many more people at this moment. So hence, you know, it's generous, but it's also a necessity to your point. The second theme I hear from you, Aleem, is, you know, that we do want to showcase the hopefulness and that we are a place of opportunity in Canada. But what are we inviting people to today? You know, it's not the same invitation it was some decades ago. Hard work isn't paying off for a young person or a newcomer of any age in the same way that it did some decades ago. So I wonder if I might use that to bridge over to you, Ian, and thinking about just, you are at the cutting edge of a nonprofit housing developer that has been working fearlessly, tirelessly to break barriers for a range of families so that they can gain stability and security and wealth through ownership. And yet the ability for you to deliver on that mission in the GTA now, by comparison with a couple of decades ago, has just fundamentally changed. And I just wonder, what's the experience been like in having to evolve to figure out how to deliver on your mission's value proposition now by comparison with the past?
It's been a constant brain twister would be my response. You know, I'm going to start by going back to the origins of Habitat for Humanity. So as everyone knows, we're a global charity. We're in every continent around the world. We look different depending on where we are. Even within Canada, we look different from one community to the next. But the commonality is a vision where everybody gets to go to sleep at night, you know, put their head in a pillow, you know, on a place that works for them. So a vision where everybody has a safe, decent place to live. And the mission is, as you cited, that we put our particular energies into enabling people not just to have an adequate home for themselves and their family, these are working families, but to be able to use that home as a way to build some generational equity and wealth. And the origins of that go back to the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s in the American Deep South, where you have descendants of slaves who are legally free, but who are in actuality indentured servants, renting shacks on the lands, the very lands that their ancestors were slaves, and working on those lands, you know, for the farmers who owned them. And the observation was, well, what if we mobilize a community to work with these families, help them build their own homes, and then instead of paying rent, which they were paying anyway, have that to become an affordable mortgage. And then they are, first of all, going to have an adequate home, and that affordable mortgage is going to help build some of what Aleem referred to in his family's own case of some stability, some financial independence for themselves. So that is our history, and that has our manifestation of that wherever in the world we are or whatever decade we're in has always had those qualities to it. That notion of being able to help people advance both by a home that works and an ability to build some financial independence through it. So you're right, here in the GTA, when I started in 2013, I will confess, I was like most of the listeners, kind of, you know, had heard of Habitat for Humanity, didn't know a lot about it. I knew that Habitat for Humanity worked with working lower income families, is the way we described it then, to help them become homeowners. And I'll confess, I kind of thought that was an oxymoron, right? Why should poor people become homeowners? Doesn't it make more sense for lower income families to be renting? And I quickly kind of realized and witnessed firsthand, you know, when I arrived, just this power of this model to enable families whose incomes may not be as high, but to have everything I just described from our history. So that was in 2013, and in 2013, a decade ago, and I thought then it was daunting in the city of Toronto. Could any of us have imagined where we would be today? And so we've worked hard at Habitat Greater Toronto Area to just keep asking the questions of how do we hold true to these principles of a safe and adequate home and ability to take your rent and turn it into paying yourself, but deal with these, you know, just incredibly challenging dynamics. So we made 2 changes over the years in terms of the equity share. So when I started years ago, the deal was, you know, you buy your Habitat home, you're going to have a first mortgage that reflects what you can afford to pay right now. As your income goes up, you'll pay a bit more. And at whatever time you sell the home, you'll kind of owe you know, if there's still money left in that first mortgage or on the full market value of the home, you're going to owe all of that back to Habitat. But all of the gain of the home will be yours, right? So that promise of building wealth, building equity, it all went to the family. And over the years, we realized that was a great deal for families. It put us in a position at Habitat that these homes that we're helping build, when one family kind of does well and moves on, it's gone. It's now a market home. So we're not doing as much good in the long run. So we changed our model a couple times to just change the formula of the share from 100% to the family to how do we kind of share that so we're able to help families in the future. Where we are today is families, when they now buy with Habitat, buy based on the understanding. When they're ready to move on, Habitat will buy their home back and will give them a guaranteed minimum rate of annual appreciation that's approximately the same rate as the way incomes will have gone up. And so that's really, so you can then have the market going up at 10% a year, but if incomes have only gone up at 2%, we're guaranteeing we'll give you a 2% return. We're still in the midst of this journey. We started this 3 years ago, and it has been illuminating. It's reminded us, like, because we so much have in the psyche of Canadians, new Canadians and all Canadians, if I own a home, I get to make a lot of money. That many people who come to Habitat, as they understand, oh, wait, I'm only going to get this guaranteed minimum, more families than ever before will get all the way to almost the finish line and say, well, you know, we're not going to do this, and actually step back from it. So that's been something quite new for us as families adjust to the, okay, is this what they want? Because in their minds, they still feel, oh, I should be able to get 10, 15% a year. The other thing that's changed a lot for us, and this was covered in the Globe and Mail and in some other media outlets a week or so ago, and it surprised a lot of people. The incomes of who we can help really changed over these years. Because in order for ownership to work, you have to pay property taxes, you have to pay condo fees, because everything we're doing, and you still want to be paying money for a mortgage. And so as home prices have gone up, we've had to adjust accordingly, such that today in the GTA, the average Habitat family who's becoming a homeowner will have a total household income around $86,000. That sounds like such a big number. And we have some families, and it's been in the headlines, some families that are around $100,000. And we know a lot of those families making what sound like a lot of money, they are not doing well. You know, gas is $1.69 a liter. You know, food prices have gone up 11% or whatever it's been in these last couple of years. The rent is so incredibly high. And when it's not just you as a single person with $100,000, but it's you and your spouse and your mother and your three children, $100,000 in the GTA, you're not doing well. Let me pause there. There's lots there to talk about.
Yeah, there's just so much to unpack there. Aleem, you want to go first?
Gosh, well, first of all, Ina is completely right. $100,000 is not enough to be able to live, you know, here. And what's scaring me right now, Paul, is that, you know, Toronto has 2,600 people every night in their shelters. Back in 2021, we've had 530. And so that number is astonishing in and of itself. I think it's telling in terms of the situation being incredibly bleak. And so I agree, you know, going back to my story, I agree that that story, fortunately or unfortunately, is not going to be the story of newcomers that come to Canada right now. And to me, that's a little scary. But what can that story be? And my story is not unique, right? There are thousands, if not millions, of newcomers that came to Canada that had that story. But what will be the story for those who follow in our footsteps? And I think that is what Generation Squeeze is trying to squeeze through. And that's where, when I was saying that, I agree, something's got to give, something's got to change, but we have to look at this holistically.
Yeah, I think that's what's so exciting about the Habitat for Humanity GTA model that Ian was just describing, because notice that the offer that Ian's organization is putting out to community members is that we don't have to think that home ownership can't be a way to gain equity. You know, you have a mortgage, you pay your mortgage off over time, and you've gained that equity. Not only that, we can think about home prices going up in parallel with earnings. And notice when Jen Squeeze has talked about home prices stalling relative to earnings, which is, we don't want any more decoupling. In fact, we want earnings over time to catch up a bit more. And I think that's what's so interesting, Ian. I think that you're describing people coming and saying, oh, my home's only going to go up relative to earnings. I'm not sure. I want it more than that. And that strikes me as the cultural problem that we have in this country that just reinforces over and over an expectation that we are going to see home prices rise. And that kind of gives rise to a psychology that fuels it and makes it so hard to ultimately slow down. So I think that the Habitat for Humanity GTA is this nuanced implementation place of actually being on the front edge of renegotiating with Canadians. What's reasonable for us to expect from housing as a place to call home? And yes, an investment strategy, but not an investment strategy that rules out the possibility of housing being a place to call home for those who follow us. And so I just want to like tip my hat to Habitat for Humanity GTA being brave to sort of take that conversation on behalf of us, because I think you make real the broader conversation that Jen Squeeze has been trying to have at the political level.
Yeah, Paul, I think that's a really good summary. Yeah, and we talked about it. Like, we're creating our own internal economy,
yeah.
Right? We're forcing our part of the market to do what the whole market should do. And it does mean families still get that opportunity of a home that's the right size for them, the pride of ownership, the knowledge that they get to decide when they're, you know, moving and relocating, not some landlord. And so all of those kind of psychic and day-to-day benefits of owning a home, and they do get to build equity. And as we say, you know, and have that discipline as their income goes up, they can put money away in a TFSA, and eventually, you know, they can take the money they're building from their Habitat home and savings elsewhere, and now they can have a down payment if they want to move to the market. And then what we like about that is if they're in a position to do so, we'll buy that home back and create that same opportunity for someone else. So mm-hmm. You're right, we're trying to get back to where things were when I bought a home, right? So, you know, I was born 6 decades ago, and that meant, you know, I got a really cheap education in the 80s, a post-secondary education in the 80s. I bought a home for $254,000 in the mid-90s, and it never occurred to me that this was going to be a source of wealth. Like, I just thought that's what you do. You hit your early 30s and you say it's time to buy a home, and so you do. And yet, as you said, it's become this kind of cultural norm. And certainly in my generation, I think it has created a sense of entitlement, right? And people brag among my generation, probably your 2 generations as well. Oh, my home has gone up in value this much. And now I'm leveraging my home to buy the second property and the third property, and it's all becoming a source of wealth. And all coupled with the, and please, I'm going to vote for politicians to keep my property taxes low and don't touch my capital gains tax. So, you know, my generation has, it's not my generation's fault, as you do a good job at Jen Squeeze saying, but we've settled into a set of expectations and a way of being that now is costing and is boxing out the generations behind us, whether they were born here or arrived here with the promise of what Aleem has described.
Mm-hmm. Well, Ian, you just modeled for our listeners what you know is one of the, you know, many reasons I enjoy collaborating with you. Use your own story so effectively to engage directly with the baby boom generation. And I think you've just articulated how on the watch of that generation, expectations about building equity through home ownership went from paying off a mortgage to hoping my home value doubles or triples. And those are 2 fundamentally different expectations for building equity from home ownership. But the role that you take as someone speaking to your generation, it's not an easy one. And, you know, what kind of feedback are you getting? Do you get pushback? How do you experience that?
Not sure. I think it's varied. Like, back to hard truths, right? A hard truth is that most people in my generation, by virtue of year of birth and time of buying the first house, and for many of us, color of skin, which also left, you know, other barriers aside, it's resulted in us having a lot of privilege. And I'm going to quote Millard Fuller, who was the founder of Habitat for Humanity. When Habitat was born, you know, he at sometimes described Habitat, because we're also a charity, he said it's a way for the rich to divest themselves of their overabundance. my generation, in some respect, has been left with an overabundance. It doesn't feel that way for everyone, right? Because we're worried about our retirement, we have a certain lifestyle, etc. But I think we need to get better at looking in the mirror or just looking around our property and saying, we, through a set of circumstances that we're not of our own making, have done better than the generations coming after us. So, and we are in a position where we can make choices in terms of how we influence a return to a future that feels more like what we had when we were in our 20s and 30s. So, you know, my encouragement, of course, is for people to donate to shelter-based charities as a way to divest of overabundance. But, and I'm sure it's where you're going to take us next, there's, we had that list of 10 things, you know, donating to charities, to shelter-based charities was one of them. But there were also a lot about how we influence our governments. You said, how do we get our governments to be disruptive, right? So, you know, my generation needs to get past the rhetoric. So my generation, all generations have to pay more attention beyond those headlines to what are the hard truths, what are the uncomfortable things about housing, and what do we then have to stand up and be okay with giving up in order for the future to look and feel more like the past in terms of fairness, and Aleem, in terms of the description of Canada, which you quoted the AgaCon as describing in those 3 points.
Well, maybe that is a lovely way for us to begin to wind up our conversation, you know, as we aim to cut through the rhetoric in this conversation on hard truths through our dialogue series through the winter and spring of this year. We didn't just want to shine a light on the problems. We wanted to help support people move towards thinking about what they can directly contribute to solutions. And then let us end today's conversation there. You know, thinking about the solutions, there is no silver bullet. There's no one thing we can do that is going to restore housing affordability forever for all. And I think as we were trying to come up with action items, calls to action for our audience members, you know, we found it difficult to identify, you know, one or two or three. We ended up, I think, with a potpourri of 10 plus activities that people could take. We don't have time in today's hard truth to summarize all of those. But if I were to put you, Aleem, and then you, Ian, on the hot seat and said, give me your top one or two things that you really think a listener today and a citizen more generally of this country can do to contribute to sort of the disruption of our housing system and the restoration of affordability going forward, what would they be?
Paul, you know, I work with such vulnerable new Canadians, and I see these situations coming up, you know, when there's development proposals, for example, and there's this sense of not in my backyard. And I don't want to name areas in Toronto, but when you look at areas that are high income, that look a certain way, feel a certain way, and areas that are adjacent that are completely perhaps the opposite. And so what I would implore people to kind of think about how they can perhaps be a solution to the problem is to ensure that when we have the right supply and when there's density conversations happening in your area, don't block them. Show up, educate yourself, be part of the conversation, negotiate what you think perhaps can be from a value-based perspective, noting that we have a problem today, but just don't show up and say no, because that is incredibly detrimental to being able to level the playing field in the various metropolitan areas in this country. And I can't say that enough. That is the part of paying it forward. Ian, over to you.
So I'm going to start on a hopeful note and actually suggest an article that you link in the show notes, an article in the last two or three weeks about Minneapolis-St. Paul as an example of, hey, here's a city where they actually are starting to succeed in reversing inflation, in reining in overall cost of living inflation. They're going against the American norm, and they actually have been successful around the affordability in the city. There are two reasons, the article explains, of why, or what's pointed to for why. The first was exactly where Aleem left off, zoning. They got really aggressive around zoning and making multi-unit, multi-res possible in any neighborhood. I was part of the Housing Affordability Task Force for Ontario. We recommended four stories anywhere, So any up to 4 stories, multi-unit, anywhere in a residential community, and 8 to 12 stories along any corridor where there's transit running. To the credit of both the province and the City of Toronto, there have been some changes made, but not at that level. We need to change the way we think of our neighborhoods. And as Aleem said, then we need to show up and say yes, not no. So that's something that Minneapolis-St. Paul did, and they're making progress. Second thing from Minneapolis-St. Paul was very intentional investment. This is on the supply side. Very intentional investment in more supply, specifically for deeply affordable. So they have put a lot of money into really speeding up that engine of the supply of affordability. So zoning gets at more supply of everything, and then intentional government investment incentives concession gets at supply of what the lower income households can afford. So it is a success story. And to be clear, Minneapolis-St. Paul is where George Floyd was murdered. And they're very forthright about, they still have lots and lots of issues in that city, but they are making progress. It is evidence that these are the things that we can also support in our communities. And I'd add one more, which Paul, you talked about, is the disruptive governments. We need to get more tolerant, and we need to look past the headlines and whatever the journalists choose to write about the policy efforts our governments make. In Ontario last fall, and they came out with the biggest omnibus bill of changes around housing to get at housing supply. And for the most part, the criticisms from even in my community and the affordable housing group, certainly in the media, was fairly uniformly negative. So people's first place was to assume this would be bad. We need to get better at getting past the let's just assume our governments are doing the wrong thing, and look deeper to say, okay, is this something that as much as we don't like it, it may have been messy, they might not have done it the way we'd wanted to, this will move us forward on our shared goal, communities that work for everyone.
You know, Ian and Paul, housing is not a partisan issue. And I couldn't underscore that more, that we have to look at this as a non-partisan issue. And I really do think, I really do know, and I feel it. And me, my community, others around me that may look or not look like me, are products of this country's ability to welcome newcomers, to create a great pathway. Our future is actually not bleak. Our future has the ability to continue to be a really good one for many people in this country. We have the tenets of that. We have a track record of that historically. That is decades and decades and decades long. You can't reverse that. And so I think we need to look at this from a point of optimism, look at the facts in terms of the history, and also, let's just move forward.
Well, let us end there, my friends. It has been so fun to bring the, as I said, the band back together. I'd been missing our conversations as we were planning and orchestrating the dialogue series in the GTA, and I'd been really keen to extend the depth of those conversations to listeners from coast to coast through our podcast. So thank you for joining us. Thank you for the hopeful point on which we ended, Aleem. I think both your and Ian's observations about let's identify the strengths of the housing policies that our governments, federal, provincial, and municipal have been putting in place, and then thinking about what we can layer there still further to address the current level of crisis that's been created by this gap between home prices, rents, and our local incomes. You both make me feel optimistic. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Here, here. Thanks for your leadership on this, Paul.
100%.
Thanks so much for listening to Generation Squeeze's Hard Truths. Check the show notes or gensqueeze.ca for the articles mentioned today, as well as videos from the Housing in the GTA events that inspired this episode.